Ginny made a doubtful face. I don't necessarily buy that. You think it was like a goodbye, one last embrace for old time's sake? Maybe even simpler. You know, men almost never say no to a fuck if it's offered to them. It sounds as if he's been living the life of a monk since she left him. His hormones are probably giving him hell. She's attractive, you say? Very sexy looking. So, if she walked in wearing a tight sweater and started making moves on him, he probably couldn't help getting a hard-on. And once that happens, a man's brain cuts out and the autopilot in his dick takes control. You think so? Listen, I've never met Michael, but I've known some men, good and bad, and that's my take on the scenario. What would you do? I'd talk to him, ask him why he did it, see what he says. See if I believed him. If he gave me a line of bullshit, I'd forget him. But if he seemed honest, I'd try to make some kind of sense of the whole incident. I have to call him anyway, Judy said. He still hasn't sent me that list. So call, get the list, then ask him what he thinks he's doing. You're feeling embarrassed, but he has something to apologize for, too. I guess you're right. It was not yet 8 o'clock, but they were both in a hurry to get to work. Judy paid the check, and they went out to their cars. Boy, Judy said, I'm beginning to feel better about this. Thank you. Ginny shrugged. What are girlfriends for? Let me know what he says. Judy got into her car and dialed Michael's number. She was afraid he might be asleep, and she would find herself talking to him while he was in bed with his wife. However, his voice sounded alert, as if he had been up for a while. I'm sorry about your door, she said. Why did you do it? He sounded more curious than angry. I couldn't understand why you didn't answer. Then I heard a scream. I thought you must be in some kind of trouble. What brought you here so late? You didn't send me that list of earthquake sites. Oh, that's right, it's on my desk. I just forgot. I'll fax it now. Thanks. She gave him the fax number of the new emergency operations center. Michael, there's something I have to ask you. She took a deep breath. Asking this question was harder than she had anticipated. She was no shrinking violet, but she was not as brash as Ginny. She swallowed and said, You gave me the impression you were growing fond of me. Why did you sleep with your wife? There, it was out. At the other end of the line there was a long silence. Then he said, This is not a good time. Okay. She tried to keep the disappointment out of her voice. I'll send that list right away. Thanks. She hung up and started the engine. Ginny's idea had not been so great after all. It took two to talk, and Michael was not willing. When she reached the officers' club, Michael's fax was waiting for her. She showed it to Carl Theobald. We need surveillance teams at each of these locations, watching out for a seismic vibrator, she said. I was hoping to use the police, but I don't think we can. They might talk. And if local people find out that we think they're a target, they'll panic. So we have to use FBI personnel. Okay. Carl frowned at the sheet. You know, these locations are awful big. One team can't really watch an area a mile square. Should we put on multiple teams? Or could your seismologist narrow it down? I'll ask him. Judy picked up the phone and dialed Michael again. Thanks for the facts, she said. She explained the problem. I'd have to visit the sites myself, he said. Signs of earlier earthquake activity, such as dried-up stream beds or fault scarp, would give me a more precise fix. Would you do that today? She said immediately. I can take you to all the locations in an FBI helicopter. Sure, I guess, he said. I mean, of course I will. You could be saving lives. Exactly. Can you find your way to the officers' club in the Presidio? Sure. By the time you get here, the chopper will be waiting. Okay. I appreciate this, Michael. You're welcome. But I'd still like to know why you slept with your wife. She hung up. It was a long day. Judy, Michael, and Carl Theobald covered 1,000 miles in the helicopter. By nightfall, they had set up round-the-clock surveillance at the 5 locations on Michael's list. They returned to the Presidio. The helicopter landed on the deserted parade ground. The base was a ghost town, with its moldering office buildings and rows of vacant houses. Judy had to go into the Emergency Operations Center and report to a big shot from FBI headquarters in Washington who had shown up at 9 o'clock that morning with a take-charge air. But first, she walked Michael to his car in the darkened parking lot. "What if they slipped through the surveillance?" she said. "I thought your people were good." "They're the best, but what if? Is there some way I can get notified real fast if there's a tremor anywhere in California?" "Sure," he said. "I could set up online seismography right here at your command post. I just need a computer and an ISDN phone line." "No problem. Would you do it tomorrow?" "Okay. That way you'll know immediately if they start the seismic vibrator someplace that's not on the list."
"Is that likely?"
"I don't think so. If their seismologist is competent, he'll pick the same place as I picked. And if he's incompetent, they probably won't be able to trigger an earthquake."
"Good," she said. "Good."
She would remember that. She could tell the Washington big shot that she had the crisis under control. She looked up at Michael's shadowed face.
"Why did you sleep with your wife?"
"I've been thinking about that all day."
"Me too."
"I guess I owe you some kind of explanation."
"I think so."
"Until yesterday, I was sure it was over. Then last night, she reminded me of the things that had been good about our marriage. She was beautiful, fun, affectionate, and sexy. More important, she made me forget all the things that were bad."
"Such as?"
He sighed. "I think Melanie is drawn to authority figures. I was her professor. She wants the security of being told what to do. I expected an equal partner, someone who would share decisions and take responsibility. She resented that."
"I get the picture."
"And there's something else. Deep down, she's mad as hell at the whole world. Most of the time she hides it, but when she's frustrated, she can be violent. She would throw things at me, heavy things, like a casserole dish one time. She never hurt me, she's just not strong enough, though if there was a gun in the house, I'd be scared. But that level of hostility is hard to live with."
"And last night?"
"I forgot all that. She seemed to want to try again, and I thought maybe we should, for Dusty's sake. Plus..." She wished she could read his expression, but it was too dark.
"What?"
"I want to tell you the truth, Judy, even though you'll be offended by it. So I have to admit that it wasn't as rational and decent as I'm pretending. Part of it was that she's a beautiful woman, and I wanted to fuck her. Now I've said it." She smiled in the dark. Ginny had been half right, anyway.
"I knew that," she said. "But I'm glad you told me. Good night."
She walked away. "Good night," he said, sounding bewildered. A few moments later, he called after her. "Are you angry?"
"No,"
she said over her shoulder.
"Not anymore."
Priest expected Melanie to return to the commune around mid-afternoon. When supper time came and she still had not arrived, he started to worry. By nightfall, he was frantic. What had happened to her? Had she decided to go back to her husband? Had she confessed everything to him? Was she even now spilling the beans to Agent Judy Maddox in an interrogation room at the federal building in San Francisco? He could not sit still in the cookhouse or lie on his bed. He took a candle lamp and walked across the vineyard and through the woods to the parking circle and waited there, listening for the engine of her old Subaru, or the throb of the FBI helicopter that would herald the end of everything. Spirit heard it first. He cocked his ears, tensed, then ran up the mud road, barking. Priest stood up, straining his hearing. It was the Subaru. Relief swamped him. He watched the lights approach through the trees. He had the beginnings of a headache. He had not had a headache for years. Melanie parked erratically, got out, and slammed the car door.
"I hate you," she said to Priest. "I hate you for making me do that."
"Was I right?" he said. "Is Michael making a list for the FBI?"
"Fuck you!"
Priest realized he had goofed. He should have been understanding and sympathetic. For a moment he had allowed his anxiety to cloud his judgment. Now he would have to spend time talking her around. "I asked you to do it because I love you. Don't you understand that?"
"No, I don't. I don't understand anything."
She folded her arms across her chest and turned away from him, staring into the darkness of the woods. "All I know is I feel like a prostitute." Priest was bursting to know what she had found out, but he made himself calm. "Where have you been?" he said.
"Driving around. I stopped for a drink."
He was silent for a minute. Then he said, "A prostitute does it for money. Then she spends the money on stupid clothes and drugs. You did it to save your child. I know you feel bad, but you're not bad. You're good." At last she turned to him. There were tears in her eyes.
"It's not just that we had sex," she said. "It's worse than that. I liked it. That's what makes me feel ashamed. I came. I really did. I screamed."
This book is continued on Disc 9. Disc 9.
"It's worse than that. I liked it. That's what makes me feel ashamed. I came. I really did. I screamed."
Priest felt a hot wave of jealousy and strained to suppress it. He would make Michael Quercus suffer for that one day, but now was not the time to say so. He needed to cool things down here.
"It's okay," he murmured. "Really, it's okay. I understand. Weird things happen."
He put his arms around her and hugged her. Slowly she relaxed. He could feel the tension leaving her bit by bit.
"You don't mind?" she said. "You're not mad?"
"Not a bit," he lied, stroking her long hair. "Come on, come on."
"You were right about the list," she said.
"At last." That FBI woman had asked Michael to work out the best locations for an earthquake, just the way you imagined it.
"Of course she did. I'm so damn smart."
Melanie went on. "He was sitting at his computer when I got there, just finishing." "So what happened?"
"I made him dinner and like that."
Priest could imagine. If Melanie decided to be seductive, she was irresistible. And she was at her most alluring when she wanted something. She probably took a bath and put on a robe, then moved around the apartment smelling of soap and flowers, pouring wine or making coffee, letting the robe fall open now and again to show him tantalizing glimpses of her long legs and her soft breasts. She would have asked Michael questions and listened intently to his answers, smiling at him in a way that said, "I like you so much, you can do anything you want with me." When the phone rang, I told him not to answer, then I took it off the hook. But the damn woman came over anyway, and when Michael didn't answer the door, she broke it down. Boy, did she have a shock. Priest figured she needed to get all this off her chest, so he did not hurry her. She almost died of embarrassment.
Did he give her the list?
Not then. I guess she was too confused to ask. But she called this morning and he faxed it to her.
And did you get it?
While he was in the shower, I got to his computer and printed out another copy.
So where the hell is it?
She reached into the back pocket of her jeans, pulled out a single sheet of paper folded in four, and gave it to Priest.
Thank God.
He unfolded it and looked at it in the light of the lamp. The typed letters and numbers meant nothing to him. These are the places he's told her to watch?
Yes, they're going to stake out each of these locations, looking for a seismic vibrator, just the way you predicted.
Judy Maddox was clever. The FBI surveillance would make it very difficult for him to operate the seismic vibrator, especially if he had to try several different locations, as he had in Owens Valley. But he was even cleverer than Judy. He had anticipated this move by her, and he had thought of a way around it. "You understand how Michael picked these sites?" he said.
"Sure, they're the places where the tension in the fault is highest."
"So you could do the same thing." I already have, and I picked the same place as he did. He folded the paper and gave it back to her. Now listen very carefully. This is important. Could you look over the data again and pick the 5 next best locations?
Yes.
And could we cause an earthquake at one of them?
Probably, she said. It's maybe not as sure, but the chances are good.
Then that's what we'll do. Tomorrow we'll take a look at the new sites. Right after I talk to Mr. Honeymoon.
Chapter 16. At 5 a.m., the guard at the entrance to the Los Alamos place was yawning. He became alert when Melanie and Priest pulled up in the Cuda. Priest got out of the car.
"How are you, buddy?" he said as he walked across to the gate.
The guard hefted his rifle, assumed a mean expression, and said, "Who are you and what do you want?"
Priest hit him in the face very hard, crushing his nose. Blood spurted. The guard cried out, his hands flying to his face.
Priest said, "Ow!"
His fist hurt. It was a long time since he had punched anyone.
His instincts took over. He kicked the guard's legs from under him. The man fell on his back, and his rifle went flying through the air.
Priest kicked him in the ribs 3 or 4 times, fast and hard, trying to break the bones. Then he kicked his face and head. The man curled up in a ball, sobbing in pain, helpless with fear.
Priest stopped, breathing hard. It all came back to him in a flood of remembered excitement. There had been a time when he had done this sort of thing every day. It was so easy to frighten people when you knew how.
He knelt and took the handgun from the man's belt. This was what he had come for. He looked at the weapon in disgust. It was a reproduction of a long-barreled .44 caliber Remington revolver, originally manufactured in the days of the Wild West. It was a stupid, impractical firearm, the kind owned by collectors and kept in a felt-lined display case in the den. It was not for shooting people. He broke it open. It was loaded. That was all he really cared about. He returned to the car and got in. Melanie was at the wheel. She was pale and bright-eyed, breathing fast as if she had just taken cocaine. Priest guessed she had never witnessed serious violence.
"Will he be okay?" she said in an excited voice.
Priest glanced back at the guard. He was lying on the ground, his hands to his face, rocking slightly.
"Sure he will," Priest said.
"Wow!"
"Let's go to Sacramento."
Melanie pulled away.
After a while, she said, "Do you really think you can talk this Honeymoon guy around?"
"He's got to see sense," Priest said, sounding more confident than he felt. "Look at the choice he has. Number 1, an earthquake that will do millions of dollars of damage. Or number 2, a sensible proposal to reduce pollution. Plus, if he picks number 1, he faces the same choice all over again 2 days later. He has to take the easy road."
"I guess," Melanie said.
They reached Sacramento a few minutes before 7 a.m. The state capital was quiet this early. A few cars and trucks moved unhurriedly along the broad, empty boulevards. Melanie parked near the Capitol building. Priest put on a baseball cap and tucked his long hair up inside it. Then he donned sunglasses.
"Wait for me right here," he said. "I may be a couple of hours."
Priest walked around the Capitol block. He had hoped there would be a surface-level parking lot, but he was disappointed. The ground around was all garden with magnificent trees. On either side of the building, a ramp led down to an underground garage. Both ramps were monitored by security guards in sentry booths. Priest approached one of the large, imposing doors. The building was open, and there was no security check at the entrance. He went into a grand hall with a mosaic-tiled floor. He took off the sunglasses, which looked conspicuous indoors, and followed a staircase down to the basement. There was a coffee shop where a few early workers were getting a charge of caffeine. He walked past them, looking as if he belonged here, and followed a corridor he thought must lead to the parking garage. As he approached the end of the corridor, a door opened and a fat man in a blue blazer came through. Behind the man, Priest saw cars. Bingo. He slipped into the garage and looked around. It was almost empty. There were a few cars, a sport utility, and a sheriff's car parked in the marked spaces. He saw no one. He slipped behind the back of the sport utility. It was a Dodge Durango. From here, peering through the car windows, he could see the entrance to the garage and the door that led inside the building. Other cars parked on either side of the Durango would shield him from the gaze of new arrivals. He settled to wait. This is their last chance. There's still time to negotiate and avoid a catastrophe. But if this doesn't work, boom. Al Honeymoon was a workaholic, Priest figured. He would arrive early. But there was a lot that could go wrong. Honeymoon could be spending the day at the governor's residence. He might call in sick today. Perhaps he had meetings in Washington. Maybe he was on a trip to Europe. His wife could be having a baby. Priest did not think he would have a bodyguard. He was not an elected official, just a government employee. Would he have a chauffeur? Priest had no idea. That would spoil everything. A car pulled in every few minutes. Priest studied the drivers from his hiding place. He did not have to wait long. At 7:30, a smart dark blue Lincoln Continental drove in. Behind the wheel was a black man in a white shirt and tie. It was Honeymoon. Priest recognized him from the newspaper photos. The car pulled into a slot near the Durango. Priest put on his sunglasses, crossed the garage swiftly, opened the near side door of the Lincoln, and slid into the passenger seat before Honeymoon could get his seatbelt off. He showed him the gun. "Pull out of the garage," he said. Honeymoon stared at him. "Who the hell are you?" "Arrogant son of a bitch in a chalk-striped suit with a pin through the collar of your shirt, I'll ask the frigging questions." Priest cocked the hammer of the revolver. "I'm the maniac who's going to put a bullet in your guts unless you do as I say. Now drive." "Fuck," Honeymoon said feelingly. "Fuck." Then he started the car and pulled out of the garage. "Smile nicely at the security guard and drive slowly by," Priest said. "You say one word to him and I'll kill him." Honeymoon did not reply. He slowed the car as it approached the sentry booth. For a moment, Priest thought he was going to try something. Then they saw the guard, a middle-aged black man with white hair. Priest said, "If you want this brother to die, just go ahead with what's on your mind." Honeymoon cursed under his breath and drove on. "Take Capitol Mall out of town," Priest told him. Honeymoon drove around the Capitol building and headed west on the broad avenue that led to the Sacramento River. "What do you want?" he said. He hardly seemed afraid, more impatient. Priest would have liked to shoot him. This was the asshole who had made the dam possible. He had done his best to ruin Priest's life. And he was not a bit sorry. He really did not care. A bullet in the guts was hardly punishment enough. Controlling his anger, Priest said, "I want to save people's lives." "You're the Hammer of Eden guy, right?" Priest did not answer. Honeymoon was staring at him. Priest guessed he was trying to memorize his features. Smartass. "Watch the goddamn road." Honeymoon looked ahead. They crossed the bridge. Priest said, "Take I-80 toward San Francisco."
"Where are we going?"
"You ain't going nowhere." Honeymoon pulled onto the freeway. "Drive at 50 in the slow lane." "Why the hell won't you give me what I'm asking for?" Priest had intended to stay cool, but Honeymoon's arrogant calm enraged him. "Do you want a friggin' earthquake?" Honeymoon was deadpan.
"The governor can't give in to blackmail, you must know that."
"You can get around that problem," Priest argued. "Give out that you were planning a freeze anyway."
"No one would believe us. It would be political suicide for the governor."
"It would like hell. You can fool the public. What are spin doctors for?"
"I'm the best there is, but I can't do miracles. This is too high profile. You shouldn't have brought John Truth into it."
Priest said angrily, "No one listened to us until John Truth got on the case."
"Well, whatever the reason, this is now a public face-off, and the governor can't back down. If he did, the state of California would be open to blackmail by every idiot with a hunting rifle in his hand and a bug up his ass about some damn cause. But you could back off."
"The bastard is trying to talk me around." Priest said, "Take the first exit and head back into town." Honeymoon indicated right and went on talking. "Nobody knows who you people are or where to find you. If you drop the whole thing now, you can get away with it.
no real harm has been done. But if you set off another earthquake, you'll have every law enforcement agency in the United States after you, and they won't give up until they find you. No one can hide forever. Priest was angered. Don't you threaten me, he yelled. I'm the one with the motherfucking gun. I haven't forgotten that. I'm trying to get us both out of this without further damage. Honeymoon had somehow taken control of the conversation. Priest felt sick with frustration. You listen to me, he said. There's only one way out of this. Make an announcement today. No more power plant building in California. I can't do that. Pull over. We're on the freeway. Pull the fuck over! Honeymoon slowed the car and stopped on the shoulder of the road. The temptation to shoot was strong, but Priest resisted it. Get out of the car. Honeymoon put the shift in park and got out. Priest slid over behind the wheel. You got until midnight to see sense, he said. He pulled away. In the rearview mirror, he saw Honeymoon try to wave down a passing car. It drove right by. He tried again. No one would stop. Seeing the big man in his expensive suit and shiny shoes, standing at the dusty roadside trying to get a ride, gave Priest a small measure of satisfaction and helped to quell the nagging suspicion that Honeymoon had somehow got the better of the encounter, even though Priest had held the gun. Honeymoon gave up waving at cars and began to walk. Priest smiled and drove on into town. Melanie was waiting where he had left her. He parked the Lincoln, leaving the keys in, and got into the Cuda. What happened? Melanie said. Priest shook his head in disgust. Nothing, he said angrily. It was a waste of time. Let's go. She started the car and pulled away. Priest rejected the first location Melanie took him to. It was a small seaside town 50 miles north of San Francisco. They parked on the cliff top, where a stiff breeze rocked the old Cuda on its tired springs. Priest rolled down the window to smell the sea. He would have liked to take off his boots and walk barefoot along the beach, feeling the damp sand between his toes, but there was no time. The location was very exposed. The truck would be too conspicuous here. It was a long distance from the freeway, so there could be no quick getaway. Most important of all, there was not much of value here to be destroyed. Just a few houses clustered around a harbor. Melanie said, "An earthquake sometimes does the greatest damage many miles from its epicenter." "But you can't be sure of that," Priest said. "True, you can't be sure of anything. Still, the best way to bring down a skyscraper is to have an earthquake underneath it, am I right?" "All other things being equal, yes." They drove south through the green hills of Marin County and across the Golden Gate Bridge. Melanie's second location was in the heart of the city. They followed Route 1 through the Presidio and Golden Gate Park and pulled up not far from the San Francisco campus of Cal State University. "This is better," Priest said immediately. All around him were homes and offices, stores and restaurants. "A tremor with its epicenter here would cause the most damage at the marina," Melanie said. "How come? That's miles away." "It's all reclaimed land. The underlying sedimentary deposits are saturated with water. That amplifies the shaking, whereas the ground here is probably solid. And these buildings look strong. Most buildings survive an earthquake. The ones that fall down are made of unreinforced masonry, typically low-income housing, or concrete frame structures without bracing." This was all quibbling, Priest decided. She was just nervous. "An earthquake is a friggin' earthquake, for Christ's sake. No one knows what's going to fall down. I don't care, so long as something does." "Let's look at another place," he said. Melanie directed him south on Interstate 280. Right where the San Andreas Fault crosses Route 101, there's a small town called Felicitas, she said. They drove for 20 minutes. They almost passed the exit ramp for Felicitas. "Here, here!" Melanie yelled. "Didn't you see the sign?" Priest wrenched the wheel to the right and made the ramp. "I wasn't looking," he said. The exit led to a vantage point overlooking the town. Priest stopped the car and got out. Felicitas was laid out in front of him like a picture. Main Street ran from left to right across his field of vision,
lined with low clapboard stores and offices, a few cars parked slantwise in front of the buildings. There was a small wooden church with a bell tower. North and south of the main drag was a neat grid of tree-lined streets. All the houses were one story. At either end of the town, the street became a pre-freeway country road and disappeared among fields. The landscape north of the town was split by a meandering river like a jagged crack in a window. In the distance was a railway track as straight as a draftsman's line from east to west. Behind Priest, the freeway ran along a viaduct on high concrete arches. Stepping down the hill was a cluster of six huge bright blue pipes. They dipped under the freeway, past the town to the west, and disappeared over the horizon, looking like an infinite xylophone. "What the hell is that?" Priest said. Melanie thought for a moment. "I think it must be a gas pipeline." Priest breathed a long sigh of satisfaction. "This place is perfect," he said. They made one more stop that day. After the earthquake, Priest would need to hide the seismic vibrator. His only weapon was the threat of more earthquakes. He had to make Honeymoon and Governor Robeson believe he had the power to do this again and again until they gave in. So it was crucial that he kept the truck hidden away. It was going to become more and more difficult to drive the vibrator on public roads, so he needed to hide it someplace where he could, if necessary, trigger a third earthquake without moving far. Melanie directed him to 3rd Street, which ran parallel with the shore of the huge natural harbor that was San Francisco Bay. Between 3rd and the waterfront was a run-down industrial neighborhood. There were disused railway tracks along the potholed streets, rusting, derelict factories, empty warehouses with smashed windows, and dismal yards full of pallets, tires, and wrecked cars. "This is good," Priest said. "It's only half an hour from Felicitas, and it's the kind of district where nobody takes much interest in their neighbors." Realtor signs were optimistically fixed to some of the buildings. Melanie, posing as Priest's secretary, called the number on one of the signs and asked if they had a warehouse to rent, real cheap, about 1,500 square feet. An eager young salesman drove out to meet them an hour later. He showed them a crumbling cinder block ruin with holes in the corrugated roof. There was a broken sign over the door, which Melanie read aloud. "Perpetua Diaries." There was plenty of room to park the seismic vibrator. The place also had a working bathroom and a small office with a hot plate and a big old Zenith TV left by the previous tenant. Priest told the salesman he needed a place to store barrels of wine for a month or so. The man did not give a damn what Priest wanted to do with the space. He was delighted to get some rent on a near valueless property. He promised to have the power and water turned on by the following day. Priest paid him 4 weeks' rent in advance, cash, from the secret stash he kept in his old guitar. The salesman looked like it was his lucky day. He gave Melanie the keys, shook hands, and hurried away before Priest could change his mind. Priest and Melanie drove back to Silver River Valley. Thursday evening, Judy Maddox took a bath. Lying in the water, she remembered the Santa Rosa earthquake that had so frightened her when she was in first grade. It came back to her as vividly as if it were yesterday. Nothing could be more terrifying than to find that the ground beneath your feet was not fixed and stable, but treacherous and deadly. Sometimes, in quiet moments, she saw nightmare visions of multiple car wrecks, bridges collapsing, buildings falling down, fires and floods. But none of these were as dreadful to her as the recollection of her own terror at 6 years of age. She washed her hair and thrust the memory to the back of her mind. Then she packed an overnight bag and went back to the officers' club at 10 p.m. The command post was quiet, but the atmosphere was tense. Still, no one knew for certain whether the Hammer of Eden could cause an earthquake. But since Ricky Granger had abducted Al Honeymoon at gunpoint in the garage of the Capitol building and left him stranded on I-80, everyone was sure these terrorists were dead serious. There were now more than 100 people in the old ballroom. The on-scene commander was Stuart Cleaver, the big shot who had flown in from Washington Tuesday night. Despite Honeymoon's orders, there was no way the Bureau was going to let a lowly agent take overall charge of something this big. Judy did not want total control, and she had not argued about it. However, she had been able to ensure that neither Brian Kincaid nor Marvin Hayes was directly involved. Judy's title was Investigative Operations Coordinator. That gave her all the control she needed. Alongside her was Charlie Marsh, Emergency Operations Coordinator and command of the SWAT team on standby in the next room. Charlie was a man of about 45 with a grizzled crew cut. He was ex-army, a fitness freak, and a gun collector, not the type Judy normally liked, but he was straightforward and reliable, and she could work with him. Between the headshed and the investigation team table were Michael Quirkus and his young seismologists, sitting at their screens watching for signs of earthquake activity. Michael had gone home for a couple of hours, like Judy. He came back wearing clean khakis and a black polo shirt, carrying a sports duffel, ready for a long spell. They had talked during the day about practical matters as he set up his equipment and introduced his helpers. At first they had been awkward with each other, but Judy realized he was quickly getting over his feelings of anger and guilt about Tuesday's incident. She felt she ought to sulk about it for a day or two, but she was too busy. So the whole thing got shoved to the back of her mind, and she found herself enjoying having Michael around. She was trying to think of an excuse to talk to him when the phone on her desk rang. She picked it up. "Judy Maddox." The operator said, "A call for you from Ricky Granger." "Trace it," she snapped. It would take the operator only seconds to contact Pacific Bell's 24-hour security center. She waved at Cleaver and Marsh, indicating that they should listen. "You got it," the operator said. "Shall I connect you or leave him on hold?" "Put him on. Tape the call." There was a click. "Judy Maddox here." A male voice said, "You're smart, Agent Maddox, but are you smart enough to make the governor see sense?" He sounded irate, frustrated. Judy imagined a man of about 50, thin, badly dressed, but accustomed to being listened to. He was losing his grip on life and feeling resentful, she speculated. She said, "Am I speaking to Ricky Granger?" "You know who you're speaking to. Why are they forcing me to cause another earthquake?" "Forcing you? Are you kidding yourself that all this is someone else's fault?" This seemed to make him angrier. "It's not me who's using more and more electric power every year," he said. "I don't want more power plants. I don't use electricity." "You don't? Really? So what's powering your phone, steam?" "A cult that doesn't use electricity, that's a clue." While she taunted him, she was trying to figure out what this meant. "But where are they?" "Don't fuck with me, Judy. You're the one that's in trouble." Next to her, Charlie's phone rang. He snatched it up and wrote in large letters on his notepad, "Payphone, Oakland, I-980 and I-580, Texaco." "We're all in trouble, Ricky," she said in a more reasonable voice. Charlie went to the map on the wall. She heard him say the word roadblocks. "Your voice changed," Granger said suspiciously. "What happened?" Judy felt out of her depth. She had no special training in negotiating skills. All she knew was that she had to keep him on the phone. "I suddenly thought what a catastrophe there will be if you and I don't manage to come to some agreement," she said. She could hear Charlie giving urgent orders in a low voice. "Call the Oakland PD, Alameda County Sheriff's Office, and the California Highway Patrol." "You're bullshitting me," Granger said. "Have you traced this call already? Geez, that was fast. Are you trying to keep me on the line while your SWAT team comes after me? Forget it. I got 150 ways out of here." "But only one way out of the jam you're in." "It's past midnight," he said. "Your time is up. I'm going to cause another earthquake, and there's not one damn thing you can do to stop me." He hung up. Judy slammed down the phone. "Let's go, Charlie." She ripped the E-Fit picture of Granger off the subject board and ran outside. The helicopter was waiting on the parade ground, its rotors turning. She jumped in, with Charlie close behind. As they took off, he put on headphones and motioned to her to do the same. "I figure it'll take 20 minutes to get the roadblocks in place," he said. "Assume he's driving at 60 to avoid being stopped for speeding. He could be 20 miles away by the time we're ready for him. So I've ordered the major freeways closed in a 25-mile radius." "What about other roads?" "We have to hope he's going a long way. If he gets off the freeway, we lose him. This is one of the busiest road networks in California.
You couldn't seal it off watertight if you had the goddamn U.S. Army. Turning onto I-80, Priest heard the throb of a helicopter and looked up to see it passing overhead, coming from San Francisco across the bay toward Oakland. Shit, he said, they can't be after us, can they? I told you, Melanie said, they can trace phone calls, like, instantly. But what are they going to do? They don't even know which way we headed when we left the gas station. They could close the freeway, I guess. Which one? 980, 880, 580, or 80, north or south? Maybe all of them. You know, cops, they do what they like. Shit. Priest put his foot down. Don't get stopped for goddamn speeding. Okay, okay. He slowed down again. Can't we get off the freeway? He shook his head. No other way home. There are side roads, but they don't cross the water. All we could do is hole up in Berkeley, park somewhere and sleep in the car. But we don't have time. We have to get home to get the seismic vibrator. He shook his head. Nothing to do but run for it. The traffic thinned as they left Oakland and Berkeley behind. Priest peered into the darkness ahead, alert for flashing lights. He was relieved to reach the Carquinez Bridge. Once they were across the water, they could use country roads. It might take them half the night to get home, but they would be out of danger. He approached the toll plaza slowly, scanning for signs of police activity. Only one booth was open, but that was not surprising after midnight. No blue lights, no cruisers, no cops. He pulled up and fished in his jeans pocket for change. When he looked up, he saw a highway patrol officer. Priest's heart seemed to stop. The cop was in the booth, behind the attendant, staring at Priest with a surprised expression. The toll attendant took Priest's money but did not turn on the green light. The officer stepped quickly out of the booth. Melanie said, "Shit, what now?" Priest considered making a run for it, but quickly decided against it. That would just start a chase. His old car could not outrun the cops. "Good evening, sir," the officer said. He was a fat man of about 50, wearing a bulletproof vest over his uniform. "Please pull over to the right side of the road." Priest did as he said. A highway patrol car was parked beside the road, where it could not be seen from the other side of the toll plaza. Melanie whispered, "What are you going to do?" "Try to stay calm," Priest said. There was another officer waiting in the parked car. He got out when he saw Priest pull up. He, too, was wearing a bulletproof vest. The first officer came over from the toll booth. Priest opened the glove compartment and took out the revolver he had stolen that morning from Los Alamos. Then he got out of the car. It took Judy only a few minutes to reach the Texaco gas station from which the phone call had been made. The Oakland police had moved fast. In the parking lot, four cruisers were parked at the corners of a square, facing inward, their blue roof lights flashing, their headlights illuminating a cleared landing space. The chopper came down. Judy jumped out. A police sergeant greeted her. "Take me to the phone," she said. He led her inside. The payphone was in a corner next to the restrooms. Behind the counter were two clerks, a middle-aged black woman and a young white man with an earring. They looked scared. Judy asked the sergeant, "Have you questioned them at all?" "Nope," he said, "just told them it was a routine search." They would have to be dumb to believe that, Judy thought, with four police cars and an FBI helicopter outside. She introduced herself and said, "Did you notice anyone using that phone around," she checked her watch, 15 minutes ago?" The woman said, "A lot of people use the phone." Judy instantly got the sense that she did not like cops. Judy looked at the young man. "I'm talking about a tall white man, about 50. "There was a guy like that," he replied. He turned to the woman. "Didn't you notice him? He looked kind of like an old hippie." "I never saw him," she replied stubbornly. Judy produced the E-fit picture. "Could this be him?" The young man looked dubious. "He didn't have glasses, and his hair was real long. That's why I thought he must be a hippie." He looked more closely. "It could be him, though." The woman looked hard at the picture. "I remember now," she said. "I believe that is him, skinny guy wearing a blue jean shirt."
That's really helpful, Judy said gratefully. Now, this question is really important. What kind of car was he driving?
I didn't look, the man said. You know how many cars come through here every day? And it's dark now.
Judy looked at the woman, who shook her head sadly. Honey, you're asking the wrong person. I can't tell the difference between a Ford and a Cadillac.
Judy could not hide her disappointment. Hell, she said. She pulled herself together.
Thanks anyway, folks.
She stepped outside.
Any other witnesses? She said to the sergeant.
Nope. There may have been other customers in here at the same time, but they're long gone. Only those two work here.
Charlie Marsh came hurrying up with a mobile phone to his ear. Granger's been spotted, he said to Judy. Two CHPs stopped him at the toll plaza at Carquinez Bridge.
Incredible, Judy said.
Then something about Charlie's face made her realize the news could not be good.
We have him in custody?
No, Charlie said. He shot them. They were wearing vests, but he shot them both in the head. He got away.
Did we get a make on his car?
No. Toll booth attendant didn't notice.
Judy could not keep the note of despair out of her voice.
Then he's got clean away?
Yeah.
And the two highway patrol officers?
Both dead.
The police sergeant paled.
God rest their souls, he whispered.
Judy turned away, sick with disgust.
And God help us catch Ricky Granger, she said, before he kills anyone else.
Chapter 17 Oaktree had done a great job of making the seismic vibrator look like a carnival ride. The gaily painted red and yellow panels of the dragon's mouth completely concealed the massive steel plate, the large vibrating engine, and the complex of tanks and valves that controlled the machine. As Priest drove across the state on Friday afternoon from the foothills of the Sierra Nevada through the Sacramento Valley to the coastal range, other drivers smiled and honked in a friendly way, and children waved from the rear windows of station wagons. The highway patrol ignored him. Priest drove the truck with Melanie beside him. Star and Oaktree followed in the old Cuda. They reached Felicitas in the early evening. The seismic window would open a few minutes after 7 p.m. It was a good time. Priest would have twilight for his getaway. Plus, the FBI and the cops had now been on alert for 18 hours. They should be getting tired, their reactions slow. They might already be starting to believe there would be no earthquake. He pulled off the freeway and stopped the truck. At the end of the exit ramp, there was a gas station and a Big Ribs restaurant where several families were eating dinner. The kids stared through the windows at the carnival ride. Next to the restaurant was a field with five or six horses grazing. Then came a low glass office building. The road leading from here into town was lined with houses, and Priest could also see a school and a small wood-frame building that looked like a Baptist chapel. Melanie said, "The fault line runs right across Main Street."
"How can you tell?"
"Look at the sidewalk trees." There was a line of mature pines on the far side of the street. "The trees at the western end stand about 5 feet farther back than those to the east." Sure enough, Priest saw that the line was broken about halfway along the street. West of the break, the trees grew in the middle of the sidewalk instead of at the curb. Priest turned on the truck's radio. The John Truth Show was just beginning.
"Perfect," he said.
The newsreader said, "A top aide to Governor Mike Robeson was abducted in Sacramento in a bizarre incident yesterday. The kidnapper accosted Cabinet Secretary Al Honeymoon in the parking garage of the Capitol building, forced him to drive out of town, then abandoned him on I-80.
Priest said, "You notice they don't mention the Hammer of Eden? They know that was me in Sacramento, but they're trying to pretend it had nothing to do with us. They think they're preventing panic. They're wasting their time. In 20 minutes, there's going to be the biggest panic California has ever seen."
"All right," Melanie said. She was tense but excited, her face flushed, her eyes bright with hope and fear. But secretly, Priest was full of doubt. Will it work this time? Only one way to find out. He put the truck in gear and drove down the hill. The link road from the freeway looped around and joined the old country road leading into the town from the east. Priest swung onto Main Street. There was a coffee shop right on the fault line. Priest pulled onto the parking apron in front. The Cuda slid in beside the truck. "Go buy some donuts," he told Melanie. "Look natural." She jumped out and sauntered across to the coffee shop. Priest engaged the parking brake and flicked the switch that lowered the hammer of the seismic vibrator to the ground. A uniformed cop came out of the coffee shop. Priest said, "Shit." The cop was carrying a paper bag and heading purposefully across the lot. Priest guessed he had stopped off to get coffee for himself and his partner. But where was the patrol car? Priest looked around and spotted the blue and white roof light of a car that was mostly concealed by a minivan. He had not noticed it as he drove in. He cursed himself for inattention. But it was too late for regrets. The cop spotted the truck, changed direction, and came over to Priest's window. "Hi, how you doing today?" the cop said in a friendly tone. He was a tall, thin boy in his early 20s with short, fair hair. "I'm just fine," Priest said. Small-town cops, they act like they're everyone's next-door neighbor. "How are you?" "You know you can't operate that ride without a permit, don't you?" "Same everywhere," Priest told him. "But we're aiming to set up in Pismo Beach. We just stopped for coffee, same as you." "Okay, enjoy the rest of your day." "You too." The cop walked off, and Priest shook his head in amazement. "If you realized who I am, buddy, you'd choke on your chocolate-frosted donut." He looked through the rear window and checked the dials of the vibrating mechanism. Everything was green. Melanie reappeared. "Go get in the car with the others," Priest told her. "I'll be right there." He set the machine to vibrate on a signal from the remote control, then jumped out, leaving the engine running. Melanie and Star were in the back seat of the Cuda, sitting as far apart as they could. They were polite, but they could not hide their hostility to each other. Oaktree was at the wheel. Priest jumped into the front passenger seat. "Drive back up the hill to where we stopped before," he said. Oaktree pulled away. Priest turned on the radio and tuned to John Truth.
7:25 on Friday evening, and the threat of an earthquake by the terrorist group the Hammer of Eden has failed to materialize, heaven be praised. What's the scariest thing that ever happened to you? Call John Truth now and tell us. It could be something dumb, like a mouse in your refrigerator, or maybe you were the victim of a robbery. Share your thoughts with the world on John Truth Live tonight.
Priest turned to Melanie. Call him on your cell phone.
What if they trace the call? It's a radio station, not the goddamn FBI. They can't trace calls. Go ahead.
Okay. Melanie tapped out the number John Truth was repeating on the radio.
It's busy. Keep trying. This phone has automatic redial.
Oaktree stopped the car at the top of the hill, and they looked down on the town. Priest anxiously scanned the parking area in front of the coffee shop. The cops were still there. He did not want to start the vibrator while they were so close. One of them might have the presence of mind to jump into the cab and switch off the engine.
"Those damn cops," he muttered. "Why don't they go catch some criminals?"
"Don't say that. They might come after us," Oaktree joked.
"We're not criminals," Star said forcefully. "We're trying to save our country."
"Damn right," Priest said with a smile, and he punched the air.
"I mean it," she said. "In 100 years' time, when people look back, they'll say we were the rational ones, and the government was insane for letting America be destroyed by pollution. Like deserters in World War I, they were hated then, but nowadays everybody says the men who ran away were the only ones who weren't mad."
Oaktree said, "That's the truth."
The police cruiser pulled away from the coffee shop.
"I got through," Melanie said. "I got through to... Hello? Yes, I'll hold for John Truth. He says to turn off the radio, you guys."
Priest snapped off the car radio.
"I want to talk about the earthquake," Melanie went on, answering questions. "It's... Melinda." "Oh, he's gone. Fuck, I nearly told him my name."
"It wouldn't matter. There must be a million Melanies," Priest said. "Give me the phone." She handed it over, and Priest put it to his ear. He heard a commercial for a Lexus dealership in San Jose.
It seemed the station played the show to people waiting on hold. He watched the police cruiser come up the hill toward him. It went past the truck, pulled onto the freeway, and disappeared. Suddenly he heard, "And Melinda wants to talk about the earthquake threat. Hello, Melinda, you're on John Truth Live." Priest said, "Hello, John, this isn't Melinda. It's the Hammer of Eden." There was a pause. When Truth spoke again, his voice had taken on the portentous tone he used for announcements of great gravity. "Buddy, you better not be kidding, because if you are, you could go to jail, you know." "I guess I could go to jail if I'm not kidding," Priest said. Truth did not laugh. "Why are you calling me?" "We just want to be sure this time that everyone knows the earthquake was caused by us." "When will it happen?" "Within the next few minutes." "Where?" "I can't tell you that because it might give the FBI the jump on us, but I'll tell you something no one else could possibly guess. It will take place right on Route 101. Roger Kahn jumped on a table in the middle of the command post. "Everyone shut up and listen!" he yelled. They all heard the shrill note of fear in his voice, and the room went dead. "A guy claiming to be from the Hammer of Eden is on John Truth Live!" There was a burst of noise as everyone asked questions. Judy stood up. "Quiet, everyone!" she shouted.